Today's the day we begin our study of the tabernacle. I want to start out with just a word or two about the structure and organization of the text. The organization of the rest of the book of Exodus poses a challenge. The design and then the construction and building of the tabernacle spans 13 of the next 16 chapters in the book of Exodus. If you think about that, I think we have two chapters dedicated to the creation of the universe. We have 13 chapters dedicated to the building and design of the tabernacle. Its design is tedious. There's a lot of repetition in these next 16 chapters. A good example would simply be that chapters 35 through 40 essentially repeat chapters 25 through 31 with only some very minimal and insignificant deletions and additions. It makes no sense to treat the rest of the book verse by verse. We would be going through the same material twice. So what I've decided to do is to try to the best of my ability to combine the parallel accounts and treat them together as units. This means we'll be looking at the text pertaining to the design of the tabernacle at the same time we're looking at the text where those designs are put into play and the tabernacle is actually constructed. We'll be looking at those together even though the text treats them separately. I think it's also important to choose the high points so that we don't drown in the details. The next 16 chapters of this book get exceptionally detailed. And I'm going to do my best to pull out the high points so that we have an understanding of what this text is about without getting ourselves in deep water surrounded by tons of details. With regard to typology, which is obviously an issue in interpreting the rest of the book, I don't want you to think that I'm opposed in any way to the traditional tabernacle symbology. But unless I can grasp how a particular writer or commentator has come to his conclusions, I probably won't focus too much on those conclusions. Doesn't mean they're wrong. It means that I simply don't have a grasp of how that commentator arrived at his conclusion. And this fits in fine anyway with the idea of looking at the high points here. In the rest of the book, we have the section on the design of the tabernacle and we have a section on the construction. And then inserted in between those two parallel sections, we have the story of the golden calf, which is a story of rebellion and eventual forgiveness. And it's not an accident that the rebellion story, which is in chapters 32 through 34, appears where it does. We're going to see that the point of this is not just to give an account of Israel's rebellion without a context of the theology, but rather it's an attempt to preserve the record of a satanic assault on the religious system God's establishing for his worship. And since this system of worship points forward to Christ, any attack against it is by default an attack against the gospel and the Savior who is typified by the tabernacle. In a sense, the golden calf episode represents a return to Egypt in the form of the idolatrous Apis bull cult that we studied quite extensively in the first part of our study of Exodus. It was prominent, as you may recall, among the Egyptians, and it foreshadows not only the world that they lived in Egypt, but it points forward to the idolatry that is going to be a temptation for the nation of Israel after the conquest. Another point to be aware of about the rebellion chapters is that they are framed by commandments to observe the Sabbath as it's instructed in the law. Though the true significance of this I'll deal with later, the intent of this literary structure is to link the tabernacle and its design and its building back to creation. Building the tabernacle is tantamount to a recreation that culminates with a Sabbath command, which is in effect a new seventh day, as it were. Linking the tabernacle and its design and construction back to the creation isn't as far-fetched as it might seem at first glance, because you should remember that this is not a mere building. It's not merely a site for worship of God in the desert. The tabernacle is a piece of heaven on earth. In fact, the tabernacle will become the mechanism through which God reestablishes the communion that he first had with man in the garden, but was lost at the fall. Thus, the relation to the creation. As you know, in the bigger context, God is bringing Israel out of Egypt into the promised land, and on the way, he has given them the law, this law that will govern their lives in the land of Canaan. And now he's going to oversee the building of the tabernacle and the religious system that surrounds it. And when we think of the tabernacle, certainly it is a structure, it's an edifice. But there is also a form of worship which is going to grow up around the tabernacle, which can't be separated from it. So God's going to oversee not only the construction of this building, he's going to oversee the way Israel worships him at that location. It's a system that will define the way Israel relates to and worships Yahweh in the balance of the desert wanderings, as well as after they arrive in the land of Canaan. The tabernacle, if you want to think of it this way, is a tangible symbol to Israel that the presence of God, which they experienced in such a real way on Mount Sinai, will be ever present with the nation as they depart that place and enter into the land of Canaan. While they were camped at the mountain, when they were visually seeing and experiencing the things that we've studied these past weeks, the people were very conscious of God's presence. It wasn't a question for them. But what about when they leave this place? What about when they step away from the mountain and they move toward Canaan? Is it for them a step away from God's protective hand? The tabernacle is going to assure the people that this is not the case. It's going to be the place where God dwells, the place where he will be in fellowship and communion with his chosen people, Israel. There are some pertinent terms that I want to spend a minute talking about this morning. There are two Hebrew terms and one English term that I want you to become familiar with. Regarding the Hebrew terms, you don't need to remember the Hebrew word, but I want you to understand what they mean, how they relate to this story. And these are terms I've mentioned before, but I want to go into a little more depth with you this morning about their origin and what these terms mean. The first term is this word right here, Mikdash. It's translated sanctuary. I'll explain why it has a red M in front of it in just a moment. It's translated sanctuary. It's found in verse 8, and it occurs also one other time in chapter 15, verse 17. This word is derived from this word, Kodesh. And I've underscored these consonants so that you can see that the consonants that make up the word Kodesh also occur in the word Mikdash. The syllables break up a little differently. The vowels are a little bit different. But if you could see this in Hebrew, the two words look very much the same. Kodesh means apartness. It means separateness. It means otherness. Or you may simply want to refer to it and think of it as the English word holy. That's what holy means. It's something that is set apart from the mundane. When you add an M to the beginning of a Hebrew word, it has the effect of adding a sense of place to the meaning of the root word. So if you have a word, could be a noun, as it is in this case, or it could be a verb, and you add an M to those consonants, the word that means holy becomes a place of holiness, a place of separateness, a place of otherness, a sanctuary. When you think about this sanctuary, I want you to realize that the sanctuary is holy for one reason and one reason only. It's holy because it's the place where God dwells. That's the only reason that it's holy. That's the only reason it's separate. That's the only reason it is other than any other structure that you might see. And wherever this tabernacle is erected, it's going to become holy ground in the same sense as the ground on which Moses stood before the burning bush on Mount Sinai was holy ground. When we get further into the story of the tabernacle, we're going to study the liturgical garments that are designed by God for the priests. And you're going to see that these garments are quite complex, except for one thing. There are no shoes. Once a year, my wife is responsible for planning a Christmas party for about 200 people at her company. It's a black tie affair. Well, if you're a guy, you've ever had to go to a black tie affair. I think I've been to, 30 of these? Something like that. You try to get dressed in a tuxedo. All of a sudden, you start seeing garments that you don't normally see. I don't normally wear suspenders. I have on no cummerbund. They have weird ties. Everything feels funny. Your socks come up almost to your knees, right? You've had these on before. And you have these funny, shiny shoes that you wear. I don't know what would happen to you if you showed up at a black tie affair without those really shiny shoes. But I have a pair, and I wear them once a year. Linda lays all this out on the bed. I have to start getting ready about an hour earlier than you. I can never forget which way the cummerbund goes. I just want you to sort of imagine that. You have all these fancy clothes that all have these special things about it. And what if you showed up at that place barefoot? Just wouldn't seem quite right. But that's how it is with the priests. They have some very intricate garments, all of which have symbolic meaning. But when God designs these garments for the priests, there are no shoes. When the priests performed their duties in this sanctuary, they did so with no shoes, because the ground on which they served was deemed holy in exactly the same way as the ground on which Moses stood on Mount Sinai when he first encountered the Lord in the burning bush, and God said, "Remove your shoes, for the ground on which you stand is holy ground." So the tabernacle is going to serve as a sanctuary that's holy because of the one who lives in the sanctuary. The next term I want to call your attention to is Mishkan. This is the word that's translated in our Bibles, tabernacle. It too is derived from another word called Shakane. And once again, you can see the correspondence underlined in red of the consonants. Shakane means to sit or to dwell. Now there's another Hebrew word that also means to sit or dwell, yeshav. When there are options on synonyms, in biblical interpretation, it's always a good idea to ask yourself the question, well, if he could have said shakan, or he could have said yeshav, why did he choose one and not the other? They both mean to sit or dwell. But God chose to say shakan. Why? If you study the usage of both of these words through the Old Testament, you'll see that when God's loftiness, when his otherness is in view, when his dwelling in heaven is emphasized, usually, not 100% of the time, but usually, you'll see that they use the term Yashav. Psalm 2:4 reads, "He who dwells," and it's Yashav, "he who dwells in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds the Gentile nations in derision." In 1 Kings 8, verse 27, Solomon asks, "Is it even possible for God to dwell on the earth?" And he uses the word yeshav. Is that even possible, that he can dwell on the earth in the sense that yeshav indicates? But when the psalmist refers to God being present in Jerusalem, Psalm 135, he writes, "Blessed be the Lord from Zion who dwells in Jerusalem," and he uses the term shakane, "praise be to the Lord." He uses shakane because the emphasis is upon God's closeness. There's an intimacy that's communicated by shakane that's missing in the word yeshav. So, whereas Yashav emphasizes the idea of loftiness and otherness nearness and closeness and intimacy is emphasized by Shekinah. And I want you to notice that, like the word here, the word for tabernacle has this prefixed M. So the tabernacle, what is it? Well, it is a place where God dwells in this fashion. While remaining separate, he remains in the tabernacle in a close and intimate way with his people. So Mishkan, the tabernacle, is a dwelling place. It's the place where God will dwell among his people in Israel until the day spoken of by the Apostle John, when God will tabernacle among men in the person of Jesus Christ. And when John writes that passage, and we'll look at that a little bit more later, he uses the same term that the translators of the Old Testament, when they translated it into Greek and in the Septuagint, used. God, through the incarnation, dwelled and tabernacled among men. Now, the English term I want to remind you of is this word Shekinah, typically used in the phrase Shekinah glory. And you'll notice also there's a relationship between the consonants here. I say this is an English term. It's actually an anglicized form of Shekinah, which of course means to dwell. And it's a technical term that's used for God's presence. Now, the term Shekinah glory never occurs in the Old Testament, but it occurs quite frequently in Jewish writings, in the Midrash and in the Haggadah and in many of the Jewish documents that we read. And it was a word that would have been familiar to the Jews. And it refers to the manifestation of God's presence among men, his dwelling. You can see the relationship between Shekinah and the idea of dwelling. There's a relationship between the Shekinah glory and the tabernacle and the concept that God dwells among men. Ever since the fall of Genesis 3, God has often manifested himself through fire or through light. He does so as a flaming sword in Genesis 3:24, east of the Garden of Eden after the fall. He manifests himself as a flame of fire in Exodus 3 in the burning bush, and in Exodus 24 as a devouring fire on Mount Sinai. There's an interesting passage in Ezekiel. In fact, it's actually interesting and probably worth taking just a moment. If you look over to Ezekiel chapter 8, during the days of Ezekiel, when Israel was in the condition of apostasy theologically, the Shekinah glory was seen departing from Israel. Let me just read for you quickly the first four verses of Ezekiel chapter 8. It came about in the sixth year, on the fifth day of the sixth month, as I was sitting in my house with the elders of Judah sitting before me, that the hand of the Lord fell upon me there. Then I looked, and behold, a likeness. Now notice from this point on all the similes, all the phrases that are, it was like this or it was like that, and you'll see the failing of human language to properly depict who God is. I looked, and behold, a likeness as the appearance of a man. From his loins downward there was the appearance of fire, and from his loins upward the appearance of brightness, light, the appearance of glowing metal. He stretched out the form of a hand, and he caught me by a lock of my head, and the Spirit lifted me up between the earth and heaven and brought me in the visions of God to the entrance of the north gate of the inner court, where the seat of the idol of jealousy, which provokes to jealousy, was located. And here's the significant verse. And behold, the glory of God, that's the Shekinah glory, the glory of the God of Israel was there, like the appearance which I saw in the plain. That refers back to a previous account, which is recorded in Ezekiel 1:28 and in 3:22-23, of another appearance of the Shekinah glory to Ezekiel. So when this is written, Ezekiel is bodily in Babylon. He's not in Israel, but through a vision, the Spirit of God brings him up, and he is transported in a vision to Jerusalem, where he witnesses the Shekinah glory of the Lord. Now look over to chapter 10, verse 4. Then the glory of the Lord, this is the Shekinah, the glory of Yahweh went up from the cherub, that's an angel, to the threshold of the temple. And the temple was filled with the cloud, and the court was filled with brightness of the glory of the Lord. Here we see this fire, this brightness, this light that is associated with the manifestation of God. The Shekinah is seen here rising up above the cherub, above the angel, to the threshold of the temple, and the glory of God fills the temple complex. Now, just a few verses later, verses 18 and 19, "Then the glory of the Lord departed from the threshold of the temple and stood over the cherubim. When the cherubim departed, they lifted their wings and rose up from the earth in my sight with the wheels beside them, and they stood still at the entrance of the east gate of the Lord's house, and the glory of the God of Israel, the Shekinah glory, hovered above them." So the Shekinah is moving away from the temple. And the last verse we will look at here in Ezekiel is Ezekiel 11, verse 23. "The glory of the Lord went up from the midst of the city, and it stood over the mount, which is east of the city." The Shekinah departs Jerusalem, and it goes and it appears above the Mount of Olives, which is east of Jerusalem. And Ezekiel's vision ends there, and he is taken back again to Babylon. I think we can presume safely that the Shekinah glory departed, and it ascended back to heaven from the exact place where Jesus would ascend back to heaven some 600 years later from the Mount of Olives. The Shekinah glory does not return again to Israel until the birth of Jesus. If you recall the birth announcement from Luke 2, we read, "And the glory of the Lord," that's the Shekinah, "shone round about them," that is, the shepherds. Certainly the Shekinah was present at the transfiguration of Jesus. When he began to glow like a light, it was a manifestation of his character as the Shekinah. It was probably the Shekinah that we call a star that led the Magi to the birth of place of Jesus in Bethlehem, and it may well be the Shekinah that we should associate with the cloven tongues of fire that rested on the apostle on the day of Pentecost and announced the indwelling of the Holy Spirit. It'll also be the Shekinah glory of God that will render the sun and the moon unnecessary in heaven. And if you recall the closing words of the book of Revelation, we read, "And that city has no need for the sun or the moon to shine upon it, for the glory of God illuminated it, and its lamp is the Lamb." So these three terms embody ideas that should give us a broad vision of the nature of the tabernacle. It's a sanctuary, it's a holy place, made so by the nature and the character of the one who indwells it. It's a dwelling place where the eternal God of the universe will dwell in an intimate relationship with his people. And it's the place where the glory of God, the Shekinah, will be manifest to Israel. This manifestation of God was partial. It was partial in this sense, that though the Shekinah was at times visible to the people, it was visible to the priests. There's another sense in which God was communicating the gospel to Israel through shadow pictures. Through the tabernacle and the cultic worship that grew up around it, God preached the gospel of Jesus Christ to Israel. But he did so incompletely. He did so awaiting a full revelation that would come later as the fulfillment of promises that had been made previously. Listen to the words of Hebrews chapter 10, verse 1. "For the law, since it has only a shadow of the good things to come and not the very form of those things, the law never can, by the same sacrifices which they offer continually, make perfect those who draw near." It's the typology of the tabernacle that makes the study of the tabernacle so difficult. Because the question is always there, where do you draw the line between what is clear and what is perhaps speculation? Well, the safest place to draw that line would be from the New Testament. What does the New Testament have to say about this particular aspect of the tabernacle? Believe me, the last few weeks I've read book after book and commentary after commentary, and I fear that a lot of conjecture about the supposed symbolism of the tabernacle has made its way into print. In fact, I assure you that it has. Quick example. Do we really know that the tent pegs that stabilize the tent of the tabernacle, do we really know that they represent the resurrection because they're half in the ground and half above the ground? Do we know with certainty that the Jews painted the blood on their doorposts in Egypt in the shape of a cross? Well, perhaps all these things are true. But the New Testament didn't see fit to elucidate them for us with what I would say is sufficient clarity to make these points as assertions. So I'm going to try to communicate in our study the general place and purpose of the tabernacle in Jewish worship, and where we have ample reason to see this symbolism in types, we'll point those out. But I'm also going to try not to venture too far across that line of speculation as we go through this. Well, let's actually look at some of the text regarding the topic at hand today. And as I mentioned, we're going to treat some of these sections together. So what I would like to do is read chapter 25 of Exodus, verses 1 through 9, and then we'll skip over to chapter 35 and read verses 4 through 9. Chapter 25, verse 1. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Tell the sons of Israel to raise a contribution or an offering for me from every man whose heart moves him. From them you shall raise my contribution. And this is the contribution which you're to raise from them: gold, silver, bronze, blue, purple, and scarlet, fine linen, goat hair, ram skins dyed red, porpoise skins." Now I realize that probably for every translation we have out there, we have a different translation for that. I'm just going to read mine for now, and then we'll talk about it. Porpoise skins, acacia wood, oil for lighting, spices for the anointing oil and for the fragrant incense, onyx stones, and setting stones for the ephod and for the breastpiece. Let them construct a sanctuary for me, that I may dwell among them. According to all I'm going to show you as the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all its furniture, just so you shall construct it. And now from chapter 35, verses 4 through 9, Moses spoke to the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, "This is the thing which the Lord commanded, saying, take from among you an offering to the Lord. Whoever is of a willing heart, let him bring it as the Lord's contribution: gold, silver, bronze, and blue, purple, and scarlet material, fine linen, goat hair, ram skins dyed red, porpoise skins, and acacia wood, oil for lighting, spices for the anointing oil and for the fragrant incense, and onyx stones and setting stones for the ephod and for the breastplate." So the offerings the people will give come directly from this list. These are the words, by the way, that God spoke when Moses entered the cloud. You'll remember at the end of the last chapter, he entered the cloud in verse 18, and that's when God speaks these words to him, and he says to Moses, "Make known to the people that I'm requesting from them an offering." The offering is to be voluntary. It is free of coercion. It's made, as the text says, as each man's heart prompts him to give. And when you think about this, this is the attitude we ought to have anyway. We shouldn't have to be told this. We should give from a willing heart, and that should be the thing that motivates us to give. God asks that they do this, what amounts to a free will offering. And I want you to think back on something. These Israelites are not trust fund babies at this point. They didn't get rich working in the mud pits of Egypt. They didn't store up a fortune as a working class of slaves in Egypt, although they did have some flocks and herds. So you have to ask the question, where did all this stuff come from? And here we begin to understand and see the reason for some things that we studied back early in our study of the book of Exodus. If you recall back in chapter 3, beginning with verse 21, God said, "I will grant this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and it shall be that when you go out, that is at the Exodus, this is pre-Exodus, you'll not go out empty-handed, but every woman shall ask of her neighbor and the women who live in her house articles of silver, gold, clothing. You'll put them on your sons and daughters, and thus you will plunder the Egyptians. Then again, over in chapter 11, just as the 10th plague is coming into view, we read, "Speak now in the hearing of the people, that each man ask from his neighbor and each woman from her neighbor for articles of silver, articles of gold. And the Lord gave the people," that is the Israelites, "favor in the sight of the Egyptians." And then once more over in chapter 12, I guess it would be verses 35 and 36. "Now the sons of Israel had done according to the word of Moses." They've been told to do this. This tells us that they did in fact do this, and they had requested from the Egyptians articles of silver and gold and clothing. And the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians so that they let them have the request, and thus they plundered the Egyptians. So we begin to see the reasoning for this that occurred earlier in the book of Exodus. These offerings that people are going to be asked to give for the tabernacle were articles that were garnered from the Egyptians prior to the Exodus. If you think about it, everything that God is asking them to give are things He's already given to them. The word offering that they use here in the text is a special term. It's another one of those terms where several could have been chosen. This particular one refers to offerings that are designed for sacred use. In this case, the sacred use of these offerings is going to be the building on earth of a structure patterned after something that exists today at this moment in heaven. This is the meaning of a phrase we're going to read in just a few minutes out of the book of Hebrews that says, "Christ now ministers in the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched and not man." So once this offering is petitioned from the people, there follows a list of those things which are going to be required. The first things that are mentioned are the metals. And there are three metals that are mentioned: gold, silver, and bronze or copper. Gold is mentioned first because of the three, it's the most valuable of the metals. And I think there's good reason to see some symbolism in this in the Old Testament, because gold most of the time typifies what is of supreme value, and that is kingship or deity, or in some cases both. The next metal is silver. It's next in value to gold. Based on Exodus chapter 30, silver likely is symbolic of atonement. So the gold is symbolic of deity. The silver is symbolic of atonement. The bronze or copper is mentioned last, and it occurs in the Bible in the context of judgment, in Leviticus 26 and Numbers 21 and Deuteronomy chapter 28. So the bronze probably has something to do with the idea of judgment. The next things that are mentioned are materials that are used in spinning and weaving. They're going to be curtains, they're going to be coverings, there will be liturgical garments for the priests that will require these particular materials. And four different kinds are listed. Three are woolen fabrics that are different from one another only in their colors. And in fact, it's the colors that are actually cited in the Hebrew text. There will be woolen fabrics that are of a deep blue, the color of the sky, which probably represents the heavenly realm. There will be those that are dark violet or purple, which is the color of royalty, the color of kingship. And then there's something called the worm of scarlet. It's actually a scarlet-colored woolen garment made from a particular worm, which when crushed creates a red dye that they use to create these scarlet documents. And when we say the word scarlet, it can mean one of two things in the Bible. It can refer to sin, or it can refer to the blood that atones for sin. And I think we're going to see in this case, it may refer to both of those things at once. We'll see that a little later on in the book. The fourth item that's required are fine threads of flax. These are simply weaving materials used for making fine linen garments. Chapter 25, verse 5. Next are the ram skins that are dyed red, probably with that dye from the worm, porpoise skins, and acacia wood. And of course, the challenging term here is porpoise skins. If you look at the different English translations, the King James and the ESV say badger skins. The ASV says seal skins. The Net Bible says fine leather. The NIV says hides of sea cows. And the Septuagint says hides of hyacinth-colored blue. I will just tell you, whenever you can look at English translations and you see that wide a spectrum, the translators have no idea what they're dealing with. And it also probably means that we're never going to know for sure that we have the right translation here. If you take this word and you look at it in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew text, except for two times, the term is always governed by another Hebrew word, which is the word skins. So this occurs in the context of the word skins all but twice. And what this probably means is that we can be certain that this is the skin of an animal. The question is, which animal? Well, in Ezekiel 16:10, this word is used to describe women's sandals. I know all of you women will want to look that verse up sometime today. So we have this word that's used to describe women's sandals. Today in Arabia, if you look at the clothing of the Bedouins, they take the skins of porpoises, which are in the Red Sea, and here we're talking about that cute little animal that we all love and pay money to swim with at times, and they make sandals out of these, and they call it a tuhas. The consonants are T-H-S. Well, guess what the consonants are for this Hebrew word? T-H-S. So these are probably cognates. That means they're probably words that are the same in Hebrew as they are in Arabic. And the reason that they prefer this material for making sandals is, and it shouldn't come as a surprise, they're waterproof. Porpoise skins are waterproof. That's a very significant property when it comes to this tabernacle, which is going to be outside. So I'm going with porpoise skins. If you want to go with sea cow or seal skin, go ahead, but I'm sticking with the porpoise in this case. The other thing that's mentioned is acacia wood. The Hebrew word for acacia wood is shittim. I think in the King James Bible, that's actually transliterated, and it talks about a shittim wood. It's acacia. What's significant about it is that it's durable, it's extremely strong, and it's readily available in this part of the world. And an additional advantage that acacia wood has, in addition to its strength, is that it's lightweight. And that's important because what God is designing here is the tabernacle, which is intended to be portable. That means that whenever the camp moves, they're going to have to carry all of this stuff. So a lightweight wood makes a lot of sense here. In verses 6 and 7, we have mention of the oil for the lamps, for spices, for the incense, for onyx stones, setting stones, and the ephod and the breastplate of the priests. And we're going to talk about this later. There's just not time today to deal with that. Verses 8 and 9, we have again mention of the sanctuary, that holy place that's made holy by God's presence. And it's to be constructed according to a pattern. The text says, exactly as I'm showing you. This includes the edifice itself, and it includes the furniture that's in it. And there's a purpose clause in verse 8 that we need to point out. It's that phrase, that I may dwell in their midst. And we shouldn't be confused here. It's not God who needs a sanctuary or a tabernacle. It's Israel. God's sanctuary is the cosmos. He created it, and he created it in such a way that if you want to ever look at the sky at night and think, why in the world did God create such a beautiful and wonderful and big place? It's because it is, in effect, his temple. And even it can't contain him, because God is greater than his creation. So this tabernacle is not for God. This tabernacle is for the benefit of the people of Israel, to allow them to have communion and fellowship with the Creator, which otherwise they could not know. When the Israelites look at the tabernacle, it's going to be in the midst of the camp. They'll camp around it. They're going to be conscious of God's presence among them. And in this way, the tabernacle takes the place of Mount Sinai as they move through the desert and into the land of Canaan. This fellowship that begins under this covenant at Mount Sinai will continue because God will be present with Israel wherever the tabernacle is set up, wherever the priests are doing their jobs, and when the Levitical system is part of the worship of the Israelites. Leviticus 26, verses 11 through 13 make it clear that the tabernacle represents the presence of God in fulfillment of His covenantal pledge, "I will be your God, and you'll be my people." And there comes, through this, the awaiting of a more complete revelation, where God's name will be fully understood. "I am Yahweh your God, who redeemed you from the land of Egypt." Now there are two important phrases in verse 9. "You shall make the tabernacle according to all I'm about to show you, and according to the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all of its furnishings." If you look down in verse 40, once again, this term pattern appears. "See that you make them after the pattern for them which was shown to you on the mountain." So we know here that when Moses goes up the mountain, God showed him something. He showed him the tabernacle, the true tabernacle, which is in heaven. What Moses is to build is after that pattern. It's a copy, or it is a model. We could almost use the term blueprint here. God gave Moses a blueprint for the creation of this earthly tabernacle based on what he saw in heaven. Well, unfortunately, we don't have time to do a complete study at this point of the book of Hebrews. It would be nice, so I'm just going to quickly point out a few verses in Hebrews chapter 8 that are pertinent here, and I know we're getting close to running out of time. Hebrews chapter 8, verses 1 through 5. And by the way, the context here is the superiority of Christ's priesthood. Now, the main point in what has been said is this. We have such a high priest who has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister in, and notice, the sanctuary, in the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched, not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices, so it's necessary that this high priest also have something to offer. If he were on the earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are those who offer the gifts according to the law who serve a copy and the shadow of the heavenly things. Just as Moses was warned by God when he was about to erect the tabernacle, "See," he says, "that you make all things according to the pattern which was shown to you on the mountain." So, verse 1 refers to Jesus, our high priest, who's taken a seat at the right hand of power, the majesty of the heavens. Verse 2 mentions that this occurs in the sanctuary, which he then calls the true tabernacle, that the Lord pitched this tabernacle and not man. This means that the tabernacle in heaven is not of human origin. Verse 4 says, "If he were on the earth," and it is written in Greek in such a way that the answer to the question is, but he isn't. This says, if he were on the earth, and he's not, this tabernacle where he ministers would obviously have to be in heaven. If it's not on the earth, it's in heaven. And in verse 5, he says, "His counterparts as earthly priests are serving a copy and a shadow of heavenly things." In other words, the entire earthly system that's developing around this tabernacle is represented by the sanctuary, the temple, and eventually and the priesthood and all the Levitical system. These things are a paradigm or a model or a shadow image of a greater heavenly reality. This is what is meant over in Hebrews 9:23 by the phrase, "patterns of things in the heavens." It's this heavenly tabernacle that Moses was shown, that he saw when he ascended the mountain into the cloud, after which the earthly tabernacle was to be modeled. I just have a couple of concluding statements. Shadow pictures always point to a greater reality. They are never ends unto themselves. Philosophically, this was one of the stumbling blocks that led Israel astray. The Israelites came to believe that Judaism was an end unto itself. But the fact is, all along God had something far better in store for Israel if they would recognize it and if they would accept it. The Apostle John wrote, "And the Word became flesh and dwelled among us. And we beheld His glory, glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth." Here the word "dwelled" is the Greek term for tabernacle. The Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. He pitched His tent here where we live. And when He did this, what is it that the text tells us men saw? They saw his glory. This is the same Shekinah glory that dwelled in the tabernacle, albeit veiled in flesh. In this little verse, we see the one to whom the tabernacle, the shadow picture, pointed, Emmanuel, God with us. And isn't that the point of the tabernacle in the first place? Wasn't it designed as a place where God would dwell among his people? Over time, this tabernacle will give way to the temple, which will serve the same purpose. When Jesus said in John chapter 2, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I'll raise it up," no one knew he was speaking of himself, but he was. He was speaking of his body, the true temple, and the true tabernacle, and he was speaking of his resurrection. For it's in Christ that God surely dwells among men. If the tabernacle is the place where God surely walked among the men of Israel in fellowship and communion with them, then it's easy to see how Jesus himself is the true tabernacle. And if he is the true tabernacle, then the earthly model must point to him. And in fact, it does. Everything about the tabernacle that we will study points forward to the incarnation of Christ and the God's plan of salvation. Next week, we will pick this up and study the Ark of the Covenant and the mercy seat. And I will not be using the Indiana Jones version. Very term Shekinah glory, that phrase, doesn't appear in the Old Testament. Certainly, the glory of God, this is what it's talking about. Shekinah is just a derivation of this verb right here, which means to dwell. And the whole point of the tabernacle, the whole point of part of the point of the incarnation, part of the point of any time God manifests himself in a bush or a mountain or whatever, is he's demonstrating his presence. So the term Shekinah glory came to be a term that was used to refer to these biblical concepts, but you will not find, if you could look up phrases in the Old Testament, you would not find the phrase Shekinah glory. But it is a term that we use. I mean, I don't know, I've never done this. Would you find incarnation in the... You surely wouldn't find hypostatic union or, you know, this kind of thing in the Old Testament. But they're theological terms that we use to refer to ideas. And the Jewish writers began to refer to the glory of God and his presence and his manifestation as the Shekinah glory. And so it's a good term for us to know because it communicates well what's at play here.